December 30th, 1995, Minneapolis, Minnesota. 31-year-old Ann Barbara Dunlap disappears after her husband, Brad Dunlap, claims that she went on a shopping trip. 2 days later, Ann's car is discovered in a Kmart parking lot with her body inside the trunk, and she has been repeatedly stabbed in the head and neck. Since Brad took out a life insurance policy on Ann in the months prior to her death, he becomes the police's prime suspect, but there is not enough evidence to implicate him, and Ann's murder remains unsolved. After that, the trail went cold.
How concerned does this make you to see the car here?
I'm happy that we found it, because I'm hoping that it'll give us some clues on where she might be. I don't know what to think. I mean, it's just, at first it scares me because, you know, it's here. but I didn't know if we'd find it, because I thought the police would find it yesterday. And I talked to a guy at the FBI, and he said that generally they'll find a car after an all-points bulletin's put out in a few hours. And so he thought that maybe the car was out of town and she was out of the Twin Cities area. So when we found it today, I was really surprised. Our main effort
seems to hurt a little to realize the car's here.
Just thinking about it, thinking about her being gone, it's very hard for me. I mean, you know, it's tough.
I'm
sorry.
No, it's okay.
We just want to find her and, bring her home.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a controversial cold case, the 1995 murder of Ann Barber Dunlap. This was a case request originally sent to me several months ago by a listener named Darla, and since I had actually not heard of this story before, I decided to delve into it and thought it would make for an interesting podcast episode. That audio clip you just heard was a snippet of an interview with the victim's husband, Brad Dunlap, which was originally recorded by the Minneapolis-based TV station KARE-11 on New Year's Day in 1996. By that point, Anne had been missing for 2 days, but her car was discovered in a Kmart parking lot during a search effort organized by her husband, and you could see the car in the background while Brad was being interviewed. However, it would not be until after the vehicle was towed to a police forensic garage when Ann's body was discovered inside the trunk, with numerous stab wounds to her head and neck. And, well, there are some people, including the police, who suspect that Brad already knew his wife's body was in the trunk when he did that interview, and was putting on a show for the cameras. It turned out that Brad had taken out a $1 million life insurance policy on Ann in the months prior to her death, and had a shaky alibi on the day she went missing. There was also some forensic evidence in the garage of the residence where the couple were living to suggest that Ann may have been killed there. On the surface, it's easy to believe that Brad was the obvious suspect, but what really makes this case unique is that Ann's parents have spent the past 3 decades vigorously defending Brad and do not believe he was capable of murdering their daughter. And while it might seem like Brad had a financial motive to commit this crime, almost everyone who knew the Dunlaps said that there were no issues with their marriage and no obvious red flags to suggest that Brad wanted to kill Ann. So this has always remained a very divisive case, as law enforcement and Ann's loved ones have differing views about what happened. So on this episode, we're going to look at both sides and try and determine if Ann was actually murdered by her husband, or if an unknown third party might have been responsible. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content, as our Patreon page currently has around 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murder of Ann Barber Dunlap. Our story begins in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1995. Our central figure is 31-year-old Ann Barber Dunlap, who is employed as a marketing manager with the Pillsbury Company. For the past 8 years, Ann has been married to her 32-year-old husband, Brad Dunlap, who works as the sales manager for Environmental Graphics in Hopkins. For the past few months, the Dunlaps have been living with Ann's parents, Don and Louise Barber, at the residence near Lake Calhoun, as the couple is currently in the midst of building a new $300,000 dream house for themselves in the suburb of Medina. At around 8 p.m. on the evening of Saturday, December the 30th, Don and Louise were out of town staying at their cabin near the town of Annandale when they received a phone call from Brad, who informed them that Ann was missing. The Dunlaps were both avid long-distance runners, as Brad had once competed in the Boston Marathon, and earlier that morning, Ann went to the Northwest Racquet Swim and Health Club in St. Louis Park in order to jog 10 miles with her running team. Afterward, Ann went to a friend's house in order to attend a brunch with about a dozen other people before returning to her parents' residence. According to Brad, Ann told them that she needed to go purchase a new pair of shoes, and while Brad said she didn't specifically state her destination, he assumed she was going to the Nordstrom department store at the Mall of America in Bloomington, which is the largest shopping mall in the United States. Brad claimed that Ann left at around 2:30 p.m. in her maroon 1987 Toyota Celica, and that she had planned to return by 4:30 so that they could both run some errands and go out to dinner together. But Ann never returned, and Brad claimed that after calling a number of local hospitals to search for her without success, he phoned the Barbers at their cabin to inform them about what was going on. Don and Louise told Brad that they were going to drive back home to help him search for Ann, but before they arrived, Brad called the Minneapolis Police Department to attempt to report his wife missing. However, he was apparently told that Ann would have to be missing for at least 48 hours before they could launch an investigation. When the Barbers returned from their cabin, they helped Brad perform an extensive search of the Mall of America and its parking lots, but failed to turn up any trace of Ann or her missing vehicle. Out of desperation, Brad also traveled to the site in Medina where their new house was being built to see if Ann might have gone there, but he found nothing. Ann would remain a missing person for the next 2 days, but on the morning of Monday, January the 1st, 1996, Brad organized a search effort in which a number of Ann's friends and family members would blanket various locations throughout the city with missing persons flyers. The search team originally met up at the Barber residence before splitting up, but at around 8 a.m., after less than an hour of searching, two of Ann's friends came across her Toyota Celica in the parking lot of a Kmart store located on Lake Street and Nicolette Avenue, 2.5 miles away. The police were immediately summoned to the scene, and it would turn out that the Celica was unlocked and its keys were still in the ignition. There was immediate suspicion that someone else had driven the vehicle there since Ann was only 5'4", and the driver's seat was pushed back farther than where she normally positioned it. Of course, Brad also showed up at the scene while it was being processed, and that's where the interview with them that I mentioned in the intro was filmed by KARE 11. The police decided that they would not search inside the car until it was towed to one of their forensic garages at an impound lot, and once this was done, Ann's body was discovered inside the trunk. She had been stabbed repeatedly in the head, as well as the left side, right side, and back of her neck, and the trunk was covered in blood. Even though the actual murder weapon was never found, the tip of a broken sheep's foot blade from a pocket knife was discovered in Ann's skull during the autopsy. There were no signs of a struggle or sexual assault, but Ann had received a blunt force blow to her head with a broad, flat object, and it was suspected that this blow incapacitated Ann before she was stabbed. Ann's purse, credit cards, and her $10,000 wedding ring were missing, but none of these items were recovered, and her cards were not used following her death. Since the keys were left behind, investigators theorized that the killer had intentionally abandoned the vehicle in the parking lot with the hope that it would be stolen by an outside party, which would complicate the investigation. Shortly after the discovery of Ann's body, Brad Dunlap was brought in to be interviewed by the Minnesota Police Department's homicide unit. Detectives then informed Brad that his wife was dead before leaving him alone in the interrogation room. After watching Brad's reaction through the two-way mirror, detectives went back into the room and told him, quote, "We think we know who did it. You killed her," end quote. Brad denied any involvement in the crime and would be interviewed for a total of 5 hours before he left the station. Don and Louise Barber were not informed about their daughter's murder until Brad returned home that night, as he broke down into uncontrollable sobbing and said, quote, "She's dead, and they say I did it." From this point on, Brad stopped speaking with the media and the police and would only communicate with them through an attorney. However, the Barbers would do numerous interviews with the press in which they publicly supported their son-in-law as they expressed their belief that Brad was innocent and incapable of harming Ann. Don and Louise insisted that the couple were very happy together as they were in the midst of building their dream home and planning to start a family. In fact, the Barbers believed that Brad was more broken up and emotionally distraught over losing Ann than they were. Right from the outset, the Barbers had a sour relationship with the Minneapolis PD, as they felt that the lead detective showed very little compassion towards them during their initial conversations about Ann's murder, and became very defensive when they asked questions about the investigation, bluntly stating, quote, "Don't you talk to me about police procedure." Don felt that the police were not willing to pursue any alternate leads which did not involve Brad, and said, quote, "They weren't trying to find who did it, they were trying to frame him," end quote. The Barbers suspected that Ann was abducted and murdered by an unknown third party when she went to the Mall of America, but the problem is that investigators said they could not find any evidence that Ann was even there on December the 30th. Even though the mall had several security cameras, the tapes were recycled every 2 hours, so by the time police started an investigation, they were unable to turn up any surveillance footage of Ann. Police also said that no witnesses reported having seen Ann at the mall, but this claim would be disputed by Bill O'Keefe, a private investigator hired by Brad. O'Keefe told the Star Tribune newspaper that he spoke to several witnesses at the mall who recalled seeing Ann, including one who could accurately identify the shoes she was wearing that day, and another who said that Ann had specifically spoken about building a house. Whatever the case, even if Ann had gone to the mall, investigators never found any evidence, such as a check or credit card receipt, to indicate that she purchased anything. Investigators did not believe that Ann ever made it to the mall and suspected that she was murdered at her parents' residence. After performing 3 separate searches of the house, they eventually reported that they had turned up 3 bloodstains on the garage floor, as well as what appeared to be a blood spot on the garage door. While the assistant medical examiner initially believed that Ann had bled to death inside the trunk of her Toyota Celica, police felt that the blood spatter pattern did not indicate that she had been stabbed there, and explored the possibility that she was murdered inside the garage before her body was placed in the trunk. However, Don and Louise Barber each provided their own separate explanations for the presence of the blood. Don claimed that shortly before Ann went missing, he had cut his hand while installing a latch on a door, while Louise claimed that at around Christmas time, she cut her hand on a broken piece of glass while taking out the recycling bin. It's also been reported that one of Ann's brothers may have cut his hand in the garage during this time period. An extensive forensic analysis would be performed of this evidence, but a lot of information about it was not made public for over 2 decades, and I'll talk more about that in a little while. Another reason that investigators became suspicious of Brad is because they felt he had a very shaky alibi on the afternoon Anne went missing. Brad claimed that after his wife left on her shopping trip, she spent the next few hours running errands before he returned home. At one point, Brad said that he went to a tropical fish store in the suburb of Plymouth, where he and Anne regularly bought supplies for their saltwater fish tank, but Brad discovered that the store was closed. When police questioned the store's owner, he knew who the Dunlaps were, as they usually came in every 3 or 4 weeks in order to purchase supplies. However, he also said that it was Anne who ordinarily shopped there, and even though he had seen Brad accompany her to the store a few times, he never recalled seeing Brad shop there alone. In addition, the owner confirmed that his store closed at 5 p.m. on December the 30th, even though Brad had said he was planning to meet Anne at 4:30. Investigators also learned that Brad had stopped at a Big Top liquor store in Plymouth to purchase champagne for an upcoming New Year's Eve party. The liquor store was located in the same plaza as the Tropical Fish Store, and transaction records confirmed that Brad wrote out a check to make the purchase at 5:32 p.m. But once again, why would Brad be running errands at this time if he had been planning to meet Anne at 4:30? One of the most controversial pieces of evidence in this case was a 1-liter bottle of Chippewa spring water which was found in Anne's car at the time her body was discovered in the trunk. The bottle had a distinctive yellow price tag on the lid, which was missing the decimal point, meaning that the price appeared to read $169 rather than $1.69. Investigators shared this information with the public in hopes that someone might help them identify the store where the water had been purchased from, and tips eventually led them to a Tom Thumb convenience store located in Plymouth, not far from the Tropical Fish and Big Top liquor stores. When police questioned the clerk from this store, he recalled having sold a bottle of water to a man in his early 30s, sometime after 6 p.m. on December the 30th, and after looking at a photo lineup, he identified this man as Brad Dunlap. The store had security cameras and still had existing surveillance footage from that particular date, but even though it did show a man grabbing a bottle of water from the cooler and purchasing it at the counter, the footage was too grainy to conclusively determine if the man was Brad. This prompted police to get a warrant, ordering Brad to accompany them to the convenience store, and they instructed him to walk past the security camera in order to grab a bottle of water from the cooler and take it to the counter. A comparison was then made between this footage of Brad and the original footage of the man buying the water on December the 30th, but while a video analyst believed that they could have been the same person, the footage still wasn't clear enough for him to say with 100% certainty. Even though law enforcement still directed their suspicions towards Brad, a number of Anne's friends and family members continued to do interviews in which they defended Brad and maintained that the Dunlaps had an idyllic marriage. The only person who was willing to go on the record and acknowledge potential issues in the marriage was Judy Bradford, a former business partner of Brad's who had once run an employee benefits consulting company with him. Due to their close relationship, Judy said that Brad regularly confided in her about his personal life and that she, quote-unquote, knew everything about him. Judy claimed that Brad and Anne went through several years of marriage counseling, and there were times when Brad was apparently frustrated because his wife wanted him to spend 100% of his time with her. But in spite of this, Judy did not think Brad could have killed his wife and described him as a, quote-unquote, gentle soul. However, investigators believed that Brad had a financial motive to commit this crime. It turned out that on August the 18th, 1995, just over 4 months prior to Anne's murder, Brad had taken out a new life insurance policy on his wife with the Chubb Life Insurance Company. Anne's original policy had been $100,000, but Brad had it raised to $1 million. In addition, Anne was also covered for $745,000 on a group policy with her employer, the Pillsbury Company, of which Brad was the beneficiary. Since Chubb believed that Brad had already been planning to murder Anne at the time he took out the policy, they argued that his claim was fraudulent and invalid and refused to pay out the $1 million. So this prompted Brad to file a lawsuit against them in October of 1996. Once again, Don and Louise Barber continued to defend Brad and did not believe this provided him with a motive to kill Anne. At the time Brad took out the new policy on Anne, he had a $500,000 policy on himself, which he also decided to raise to $1 million. The Barbers claimed that Brad and Anne had mutually decided to take out their respective insurance policies on each other based on the advice of a financial planner the couple had met at Anne's suggestion. Since the Dunlaps were building a new home and planning to start a family, the purpose of these new policies was simply to provide more financial security for themselves. While there would be a number of delays in Brad's lawsuit, as Chubb revealed that the decision not to pay out the policy was based on private information they had received from the Minneapolis PD's investigation into Anne's murder. While Brad's attorneys attempted to subpoena all the police's documentation and evidence from the case, the police refused to turn it over for fear that it could jeopardize an open homicide investigation. This matter would go to U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota, and on September the 30th, 1997, Chief Magistrate Judge Raymond Erickson ruled that Brad's attorneys had the right to examine all the documentation from the investigation and ordered the Minneapolis PD to turn it over to them. Erickson felt this decision was essential in order to, quote-unquote, maintain a level playing field in the life insurance case. The case was scheduled to go to trial, but on September the 30th, 1998, after numerous postponements, Brad's attorneys announced that they had finally reached an out-of-court settlement with Chubb, and while the amount was undisclosed, they said that their client found the terms to be satisfactory. By this point, Brad was living in Scottsdale, Arizona, as all the publicity surrounding the case had prompted him to quit his job and leave the state of Minnesota in July of 1997. The case would eventually fade from the spotlight, though the Minneapolis PD still considered Brad to be their only suspect. In May of 2013, the new head of their homicide unit, Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, announced that they were reopening the investigation and looking at the case with a fresh, open mind and no preconceived ideas about who committed the murder. Zimmerman said that they had recently received a tip about a conversation Brad supposedly had in the years before the murder, and while he wouldn't provide any more specific details, Zimmerman stated, quote, "We wish the caller had called us back in 1995 or 1996, but for some reason they didn't," end quote. It doesn't look like this lead ever went anywhere, but in February of 2020, the case returned to the spotlight after KARE11 managed to obtain some previously unreleased documents from Brad's lawsuit against the Chubb Life Insurance Company, and they produced a news segment about their findings. They also published these documents on their website, which included a sworn affidavit from former lead investigator Sergeant David Voss, who stated, quote, "There is no plausible alternative explanation to Anne Dunlap's death other than the conclusion that Bradley Dunlap is the murderer," end quote. During the original investigation, two FBI agents from their profiling unit performed an analysis of Brad's initial police interview, and they concurred that he was a viable suspect. Chubb also hired a retired FBI agent named Greg McCrary to perform a crime scene analysis, and while he never specifically named Brad as a suspect in his published report, he concluded that Anne was likely the victim of a planned, premeditated murder committed by someone she knew, rather than being killed by a random, opportunistic predator. This analysis also confirmed that even though there was ample blood inside the trunk of Anne's Toyota Celica, there was no other blood on the interior of the vehicle, which suggested that after repeatedly stabbing her, the killer had time to clean themselves off before they drove the car to the Kmart parking lot. The Hennepin County Assistant Medical Examiner published a letter about the findings from Anne's autopsy, and he concluded that since she had undigested food in her stomach, which was consistent with what she ate during her brunch with her friends on December the 30th, she was likely killed only a few hours later, placing her approximate time of death sometime between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m. that afternoon. However, during his lawsuit with the Chubb Life Insurance Company, Brad had hired his own forensic experts who published reports disputing some of these conclusions. A forensic pathologist named Dr. Sparks Veazey expressed his belief that determining time of death based on a victim's stomach contents is not an exact science, and he also believed that the trace amounts of blood found in the barber's garage were inconsistent with arterial bleeding, which likely would have occurred when Anne's neck was stabbed. Another forensic expert named Bob Henderson also performed his own bloodstain pattern analysis on the evidence, and he found it unlikely that Anne was murdered inside the garage, writing, quote, "No evidence exists of projected bloodstain patterns consistent with arterial bleeding, impact spatter, or cast-off bloodstains in the Barber residence or on the garage floor, walls, or ceiling. No evidence exists that the floor of the garage was cleaned," end quote. However, KARE11 reported on some other pieces of incriminating information in these various documents which had never been made public before, including the fact that positive presumptive indicators of blood had been found in the wash tub and lint trap located in the laundry room of the Barber residence. As you might recall, both of Anne's parents had described incidents in which they cut themselves in the garage shortly before she went missing, but it turned out that DNA testing had been performed on this blood, and not only did it exclude Dawn, Louise, or anyone else from the Barber family as the sources, but it matched Anne. If that wasn't enough, these documents also revealed that a bloodstained fireplace log had been found in the garage, and Anne's DNA was on it as well. However, one previously unknown piece of information which did favor Brad is that forensic testing was performed on the water bottle found in Anne's car, and while her DNA was on it, Brad's was not. In spite of these new revelations, Don and Louise still never wavered from their support of Brad. By this point, Brad was still living in Arizona and had gotten remarried and had two children, but the Barbers said they would travel down south to visit their former son-in-law at least once per year. They claimed that Brad continually stayed in touch and phoned them just as often as their other children, stating, quote, "He is like another son. He is definitely another son. We love him dearly," end quote. Brad declined to provide comment for the new KARE11 story, and as far as I can tell, he has not given any new interviews to the media in over two decades. Following the loss of their daughter, Don and Louise started a scholarship in Anne's name, and every year, they would award it to a pair of female students from the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. Sadly, Don passed away in August of 2023 at the age of 89, without receiving any conclusive answers about what happened to Anne. After three decades, there are still divided opinions about who was actually responsible for this crime, and it continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I've covered a number of cases on this podcast involving missing and murdered women in which the husband became the prime suspect, but I can't think of any others in which there was a bigger disconnect between law enforcement and the victim's loved ones than the murder of Anne Barber Dunlap. From day one, investigators on this case have always felt that Brad Dunlap is the prime suspect, and if you search online discussions about this case, you'll find that the majority opinion from amateur sleuths is that Brad likely did it. However, this does not appear to be the view held by Anne's friends and family members, particularly her parents, Dawn and Louise Barber. I've seen so many cases involving missing and murdered victims in which their families had zero doubt that the spouse was responsible, but there are others, such as Jeffrey McDonald's murders of his wife and two daughters, where the prime suspect's in-laws initially supported them, but gradually changed their minds once red flags started to emerge. But that has not been the case with the Barbers, who have continually defended their former son-in-law over these past three decades, and as far as I can tell, until Don Barber passed away last year, he never wavered from his belief that Brad did not kill his daughter. It's also worth noting that shortly after Anne's murder, her brother, Paul Barber, started a website about her case, which marked one of the first known instances of a victim's family using the internet to spread awareness about a cold case and ask for information. Believe it or not, the original website is still up at paulbarber.net under the heading Help Find Anne's Killer, and it's pretty much a time capsule into the early days of the World Wide Web, since the site has a very old-school design and does not look like it's been updated since 1996. It appears that Paul also does not believe that Brad was responsible for his sister's murder, as during an interview with the St. Paul Pioneer Press, he pushed forward the idea that Anne had an unexpected public encounter with someone else who decided to kill her, stating, quote, "Anne had a personality that seemed to attract oddball types who try to be her friend all the time. I don't know, and I don't have any examples, but there are a few out there. There were people from high school who would maybe call 5 years out," end quote. I've also watched vintage news footage from 1996 featuring interviews with some of Anne's friends, and they also seem to hold the same opinion about Brad as the Barber family, as they described him as the nicest guy who truly loved his wife. Even though Brad's former business partner, Judy Bradford, had said that he and Anne had gone to marriage counseling, it does not appear there were any obvious red flags in the relationship, such as domestic violence, infidelity, or financial issues, to suggest that things might have escalated into murder. Now, you can accuse Don and Louise Barber of being naive and having blinders on about the whole situation, but I still put quite a bit of weight into their opinions, since Anne and Brad had been living at their residence with them in the months prior to the murder. So if the Dunlaps had any serious issues with their marriage, they must have done a very effective job at keeping it concealed from the Barbers. If that wasn't enough, Brad continued living with Don and Louise for a lengthy period of time after Anne's murder, and I certainly do not believe they would have let him keep staying there unless they truly believed he was innocent. As you recall, the Dunlaps had been building a $300,000 dream house in Medina at that time, but even though the house was eventually completed, Brad never did move in there. Instead, the house was purchased by Hall of Fame Major League Baseball pitcher Burt Blyleven, who spent a good chunk of his career playing for the Minnesota Twins, and that was certainly not a connection I expected to see when I started researching this case. Of course, the obvious motive for Brad to commit murder was the fact that he had taken out a $1 million life insurance policy on Anne just 4 months earlier, but the couple both had well-paying jobs and no apparent financial problems. During the summer of 1997, Brad relocated to Arizona and eventually got remarried and started a new family, and I could see why some people might find this suspicious that Brad didn't stick around to find the quote-unquote real killer. But once again, the first people to defend Brad's decision are the Barbers, who said that being a suspect in such a high-profile murder pretty much made it impossible for Brad to keep living in Minneapolis. Whenever Brad went out to dinner with his in-laws, they said that people would gawk and stare at him, and there were even times when random strangers would threaten or spit on Brad or call him a murderer while he was out in public. So Don and Louise were completely fine with Brad's decision to move to Arizona, and would try to go down there to visit him at least once per year. If nothing else, it seems obvious that the Barber's belief in Brad's innocence is genuinely sincere, so what could we be missing here? Well, even if the Minneapolis PD's instincts about Brad were correct, I think one of the underlying issues is that they did not appear to show a lot of compassion and sensitivity towards the Barbers, and this may have permanently tainted the relationship. Even if Brad was guilty, I do find it troubling that after discovering Anne's body, the police did not immediately inform her parents. Instead, they spent the next 5 hours or so interrogating Brad, and the Barbers only found out that Anne was dead when Brad returned home late that night and broke down crying and told them. I think this immediately gave Don and Louise the impression that instead of exploring all possible leads and seeking justice for their murdered daughter, they were just going to try and pin the crime on Brad, regardless of whether or not he actually did it. But on the other hand, once you watch the interview Brad gave for KARE11 following the discovery of Anne's Toyota Celica, you can understand why he became the primary focus of the investigation. So I played an audio snippet of this interview at the beginning of this episode, but you can find a clip of the raw, uncut version on YouTube, and it runs just over 8 minutes. And needless to say, the comment section of this clip contains a lot of amateur body language experts who believe Brad is guilty because of what he says or does on camera. On the audio I previously shared, you could hear Brad getting emotional and crying, but some people believe they were nothing more than crocodile tears and he was putting on an act. Now, I'm a person who prefers to assess people's guilt or innocence based on evidence, rather than pseudoscience like body language analysis, as different people will respond to tragedy in different ways. So I'm not going to form a concrete opinion based solely on Brad's behavior during this interview. But I will say that if Brad did kill Anne, and already knew her body was inside the trunk while he was speaking to the reporter, then this was undoubtedly one of the most brazen interviews ever given by a murder suspect. Another unsettling aspect of the full clip is that you can frequently hear the sound of a dog barking in the background, and I can only assume it was a police bloodhound who was reacting to Anne's scent from the trunk. Okay, so one thing which might seem suspicious is that Brad had organized a search effort earlier that morning, and within an hour or so, two of Anne's friends came across her car in the Kmart parking lot. If Brad was guilty, you could interpret this search effort as him orchestrating things so that someone else would discover his wife's body. During Brad's interview, he shared one piece of information which I have never seen corroborated by any other official sources, as he claimed that a friend told him that security had checked the parking lot several hours earlier at around 12:30 a.m., but did not see Anne's car. I have no idea if this is actually true, but if it is, and Brad did commit this crime, then it makes me wonder where he could have hidden the car during the two-day window when Anne was missing, and how he managed to move the car there undetected. But regardless of whether Brad or an unknown third party was the killer, I think one thing we can all agree on is that Anne's car was planted in that particular Kmart parking lot for a specific reason. From what I've read online, that Kmart was located in a pretty sketchy area, and it seemed very unlikely that an upper-class woman like Anne would have driven there on her own to go shopping. So the perpetrator likely hoped that if they abandoned the car at this location with the key still in the ignition, someone would eventually steal it without knowing there was a dead body in the trunk. This would cause a lot of potential complications with the investigation, and whoever stole the car could have wound up falsely implicating themselves in a murder. Even though Anne did not have any known connection to the Kmart, it's worth noting that it was located only about 2.5 miles from the Barber residence. So theoretically, if Brad planted the car there, it would have been feasible for him to walk back home without seeking any additional transportation. Investigators have always been inclined to believe that Anne was killed at another location before her body was placed inside the trunk, and given that small traces of blood were found inside the barber's garage, they suspect that she was murdered there. And if Brad did it, you can understand why he would have done so on December the 30th, since his in-laws were away at their cabin. So let's look at the timeline that day. The story provided by Brad is that Anne left their residence to go shopping at around 2:30 p.m., and we know that he first phoned Dawn and Louise to inform them she was missing at 8 o'clock that night. While there are definitely questions about Brad's whereabouts during that full 5.5-hour window, it has been verified that he purchased champagne at a liquor store in Plymouth at 5:32 p.m., which would have been about 12 miles northwest from the Barber residence. Based on Anne's undigested stomach contents from her last meal at brunch, the Hennepin County Assistant Medical Examiner believed that Anne was killed sometime between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m., but if you heard my recent series of episodes about Stephen Truscott's controversial conviction for the murder of Lynn Harper, you'll know that I have major issues with this idea of using a victim's stomach contents to determine a specific time of death. It's definitely not an exact science, and there are other factors which can slow someone's digestive process, such as fear and stress, which Anne would have been experiencing while she was murdered. While the 2:30 to 3:30 time frame could point to Anne being killed while she was at home with Brad, it doesn't preclude the idea of her being killed elsewhere by another party sometime after she left. What has always seemed odd to me is that Brad claimed that Anne was supposed to meet him at 4:30 so they could run some errands and go out to dinner together, but we know that Brad was running errands on his own and buying champagne just after 5:30. So if Anne failed to return home at her scheduled time, why did Brad leave and head to Plymouth rather than waiting around for her? Well, during the aforementioned interview in the Kmart parking lot, Brad did confirm that Anne was supposed to be home by 4:30, but he figured that she was running late because it was snowing, and it might have been busy at the Mall of America that afternoon. So Brad decided to go to the tropical fish store in order to pick up some salt water for their tank, but by the time he arrived, the store was closed. Even though Brad did not usually shop at this store on his own, I guess it would make sense that he might try to go there without Anne if he knew they were closing at 5 o'clock. Brad said that he called the barber residence from the store and no one answered, though it's never been specified if he owned a cell phone or perhaps made the call from a payphone. Whatever the case, since the Big Top liquor store was located in the same plaza as the Tropical Fish store, Brad presumably went to pick up the champagne before he returned home, but Anne was still not there. Now, if Brad did kill Anne, his decision to run errands on his own could be construed as him making a deliberate attempt to be seen in public places in order to fabricate an alibi for himself. However, the part which has always been the biggest source of confusion is the presence of the bottle of water inside Anne's car, as police suspected that Brad purchased it at a Tom Thumb convenience store at around 6 p.m. that day. If Brad did purchase this water at that time and left it in the Celica, then that's pretty indisputable evidence of his guilt, as there's no possible innocent explanation for it being there. Since this convenience store was located in Plymouth and wasn't too far from the liquor store, the timeline does fit, but the big question is, why would Brad do this? Even though criminals can often be stupid, I see no logical explanation for stopping to buy a bottle of water after you've murdered your wife and then leaving it inside the same vehicle containing her body in the trunk. During his interview in the Kmart parking lot, Brad even mentioned seeing a bottle of water through the windows of the Celica and said that it was fairly common for Anne to buy them since she was a long-distance runner. So could it be possible that Anne actually purchased the water herself before she was murdered? I know the convenience store clerk was certain he sold Brad the water at that particular time on December the 30th, and even picked him out of a photo lineup, but keep in mind that this case was major news in Minneapolis at that time, and Brad's face had already been in the newspapers and on TV, so the identification could have been cognitive bias on the clerk's part. Otherwise, I see no reason for him to have a vivid memory of such a mundane transaction. I know the security cameras captured footage of a man buying water from there during this time period, but the footage was not clear enough to conclusively determine if it was Brad. As far as I know, this footage has never been released publicly, and I haven't personally seen it, so I can't form an opinion. However, since forensic testing found Anne's DNA on the bottle, but not Brad's, I am inclined to believe that Anne bought the water on a previous occasion prior to the murder, and it has no evidentiary significance. What has provided additional confusion is the contradictory information about whether or not Anne went to the Mall of America on the afternoon she went missing. While police have always insisted that there is no evidence to indicate that Anne was ever there, a private investigator hired by Brad claimed that numerous witnesses recalled seeing him there. But of course, I would take that with a huge grain of salt, since eyewitnesses can often be mistaken. The same cognitive bias that the convenience store clerk may have experienced with Brad could also apply to these witnesses, as Anne Dunlap's photo was all over the media in Minneapolis during that time period, so I could see people falsely convincing themselves that they had seen or interacted with her that day. We do know that Anne never made any transactions via check or credit card, and while I suppose she could have purchased something with cash, it's not like they found any newly purchased items inside her car. You also have to remember that Brad claimed that Anne never specifically told him she was going to the Mall of America, only that she was going to buy a pair of new shoes, and Brad just assumed she would go to the Nordstrom department store. If Anne did go to the mall that afternoon, the theory pushed forward by Brad and his supporters is that she crossed paths with someone there who abducted her in her own vehicle. They then proceeded to murder her at another location, stuff her body inside the trunk, and abandoned the car in the Kmart parking lot, which was about 10 miles away from the Mall of America. And if this occurred in the parking lot right after Anne arrived at the mall, this could explain the lack of witnesses or concrete evidence placing her there. However, this would have been a busy Saturday afternoon right before New Year's Eve at the largest mall in the United States, so could someone have really managed to do this without being seen? And then there's the question of motive. Since Anne's purse, credit cards, and wedding ring were missing and never recovered, I suppose you can't rule out robbery, but she was not sexually assaulted. And why would a random robber go to the trouble of stabbing her in the head and the neck so many times? It really does appear to be a more personal crime committed by someone with an intense hatred towards Anne. I know that Brad apparently never gave off any visible warning signs of hating Anne that much, but police have always suspected that he killed her at her parents' residence shortly after she arrived home from brunch, and after putting her body in the trunk and cleaning himself up, he proceeded to drive the Celica to the Kmart parking lot and stage the crime scene in an attempt to make it look like Anne was killed by an outside party. Well, if it wasn't for the sheer number of people defending Brad, I would have no trouble believing this is what happened, particularly since small traces of blood were found inside the barber's garage. Granted, the samples weren't big enough to state with any certainty that a homicide took place, but it is odd that Dawn and Louise each provided their own separate stories about cutting themselves in the garage on previous occasions in order to explain the blood. Even though this information was not made public until 4 years ago, DNA testing did confirm that the blood belonged to Anne and did not match her parents. Now, I have no reason to believe that Dawn and Louise would have made up these stories about cutting themselves in order to protect Brad, because even though they believed he was innocent, I do think they would draw the line at lying to police in order to cover someone who was suspected of murdering their daughter. If this garage was such a safety hazard that both her parents cut themselves, then I suppose it's not impossible that Anne could have accidentally cut herself as well on a separate occasion prior to her death, which would explain the presence of her blood. But it's pretty troubling that they also found traces of her blood and DNA on a fireplace log in the garage. It's believed that Anne was struck in the head with a blunt object prior to being stabbed, and she also had no signs of defensive wounds on her body. When you look at the evidence, a scenario in which Anne was taken by complete surprise when her own husband struck her in the head with a fireplace log inside her parents' garage does make a lot of sense. It's been reported that no blood was found on the interior of the Celica, so if Brad killed Anne in the garage, he would have had ample opportunity to clean up any blood he may have gotten on himself before he drove the car to the Kmart parking lot. Of course, you might be wondering why Brad wouldn't have destroyed the most incriminating piece of evidence by burning the log in the fireplace or something, but first-time murderers who do not have any experience with killing will often make mistakes like that. And since this was 1995, and DNA testing was still a relatively new thing in criminal investigations, Brad may not have been thinking of forensic countermeasures. All that being said, even though the presence of Anne's blood and DNA on the fireplace log seems like a pretty damning piece of evidence, it still wasn't enough to compel the police to arrest Brad, so I still think there must be some missing pieces to the puzzle here. I would be curious to know if Anne's car was sitting in the Kmart parking lot the entire time she was missing, or if the vehicle was planted there shortly before it was found. If Brad committed this crime, I'm not sure he would have risked driving the car to the Kmart during business hours when he could have been seen, but we know that the barbers returned home from the cabin sometime between 9 and 10 p.m. on the date Anne disappeared, so the car would have needed to be gone from the residence by then. And once again, there's the question of Brad's motive. Yes, $1 million in life insurance money is a pretty logical motive, but neither he nor Anne had any financial problems, and you'd think that if there were any serious issues in the marriage, or if Brad had any major skeletons in his closet, such as a secret mistress or something, they would have emerged into the spotlight sometime these past 3 decades. And if Brad was guilty, it was incredibly brazen of him to file a lawsuit against the Chubb Life Insurance Company in order to collect on Anne's policy. By the time he did this, Brad had ceased talking to the police or the media, but if you file a civil suit when you're a suspect in a murder, then you may be compelled to testify under oath, and when you're cross-examined, you could wind up revealing incriminating information which might not otherwise come out if you exercise your right to remain silent. Now, since this lawsuit was ultimately settled out of court, we really don't know what went on behind the scenes, or if things ever reached the point where Brad was required to testify, but if you look at the documentation from this lawsuit, he was clearly placing himself at the mercy of a number of people who believed he was getting away with murder. In the end, Brad did get some sort of payoff out of this deal, so if the crime was financially motivated, then he technically succeeded at getting what he wanted. However, what if the main thing Brad really wanted was a fresh start? It's been stated numerous times that there were no apparent issues in the Dunlaps' marriage, but even though everyone who knew Brad said he was a nice guy whom they never saw get angry, the Barbers did acknowledge that his love towards Anne was so strong that they thought he may have spoiled her. During one interview, Don stated, quote, "He is kind, polite, sincere, and giving. She took advantage of it, and he didn't mind doing it," end quote. In addition, Judy Bradford claimed that Brad had once expressed frustration over the fact that Anne seemingly expected him to spend 100% of his time with her. I don't know if that can be taken as a sign that Anne called all the shots in their marriage, but it does make me wonder if Brad may have been a very compartmentalized person with a lot of repressed rage and unhappiness, which eventually erupted into violence. Perhaps Brad just wanted out of the marriage and felt that he could use Anne's life insurance payout to get a fresh start. Of course, you might be asking why he just didn't simply get divorced, but you can ask that same question in virtually every case where someone murders their spouse. Now, all this talk is nothing more than pure speculation, because if Brad was truly unhappy being married to Anne, it is odd that he would continue to maintain such a close relationship with his parents, especially after he moved away to another state. But then again, this could be the result of some sort of underlying guilt over having taken Don and Louise's daughter away from them. I don't know, out of all the cases I've covered in which a husband was a suspect in his wife's murder, this is definitely one of the most perplexing. I don't want to say anything negative about Don and Louise Barber, as they do seem like genuinely nice people, but I have to wonder if they might have just been in major denial about Brad. One of the main problems with thinking he's innocent is that after 3 decades, no one else has ever popped up on the radar as a plausible alternate suspect or person of interest, though I do hope that the Minneapolis PD has done their due diligence and not ignored other potential leads because they were so focused on Brad. When this crime originally took place, I don't think anyone expected that it would still be unsolved after all these years, but there has just never been enough concrete evidence to make an arrest, and it appears that things have been in a holding pattern for a while. It would be nice to see an update at some point, so if you happen to have any information about the murder of Anne Barber Dunlap, please contact the Minneapolis Police Department tip line at 612-692-TIPS. That's 612-692-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode, which is our podcast's second special edition of The Trail Revisited, and this time, I'm taking a fresh look at the infamous Circleville Letters case. I originally covered that story on the podcast 6 years ago, but I've since learned a ton of new information which has caused me to look at the case in a different light, so I decided to put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my 2 co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1989 disappearance of Patricia Meehan. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. Oh, and as an extra special bonus, I recorded an additional audio commentary over the recent Unsolved Mysteries Behind the Legacy documentary, and this one is available to all of our Patreon subscribers. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Sarah H. and Andy W., thank you all so much for your support. I'm also excited to announce that The Trail Went Cold will be returning again to the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, which is being held at the Denver Marriott Westminster in Colorado from July the 12th to the 14th. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a discount code for 15% off, so please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL for 15% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶